Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Iran knows it will face tremendous consequences if it tries to develop a nuclear weapon. That's according to the head of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. John Brennan spoke to Fox News Sunday in an exclusive news interview.
I think they realize that there's going to be tremendous costs and consequences and implications if they were to decide to go for a breakout. There are a number of things that the United States has available to it to prevent Iran from getting a bomb.
Brennan went on to say that he has confidence that U.S. intelligence capabilities are sufficiently robust and that the United States understands what Iran's nuclear program entails. He spoke a day after U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held meetings in Europe during a temporary pause in nuclear talks with Iran. Today is World Water Day. It's a day that highlights the essential role of water in human life. In India, Dr. Poonam Aluwala, an expert on environmental engineering and management, says much more needs to be done to improve distribution of clean water to the population.
Although we have the water resources, we do not have the infrastructure to tap that water resource and supply it to the masses.
A UN report says despite impressive gains, 748 million people still do not have access to improved sources of drinking water. The U.S. Marine Corps is urging vigilance after Islamic State posted on the internet that what it says are names and addresses and photographs of 100 U.S. military personnel, encouraging its supporters in the U.S. to kill them. It's recommended that Marines and their family members check their online social footprint to ensure privacy settings. This is VOA News. Tunisia's President Beji Caid Essebsi said Sunday that a third gunman in the massacre of tourists in the country's National Museum is on the loose. Two were executed, but one is on the run still, but he won't go very far. That's according to Mr. Essebsi speaking to French television interviewers from inside the National Bardo Museum in Tunis. The Tunisian president's statement was the first time officials have said there were three gunmen in Wednesday's attack that left 21 people, all but one of them foreign tourists. French voters are going to the polls Sunday to cast their ballots in local elections. The elections are widely seen as an opportunity for Marine Le Pen and her far-right National Front to build a base if expected. Le Pen runs for president in 2017. After casting her ballot, Le Pen, as you hear here, says it's already been shown that the National Front is a great force locally, that the party has shown it can unite 10 million French people in the national elections. Their hope of victory tonight will show it's a great force in local politics. Meanwhile, opinion polls indicate Le Pen's National Front is running a close race against the ruling socialists of President Francois Hollande. A woman killed by an angry mob in front of police in the Afghan capital last week for allegedly burning a copy of Islam's holy book was wrongly accused. That's according to Afghanistan's top criminal investigator. Mobile phone footage circulating on social media shows that police at the scene did not save the 27-year-old woman, Farkunda, who was beaten with sticks and set on fire by a crowd of men in central Kabul in broad daylight on Thursday. Hundreds of people attended her funeral on Sunday, chanting, "We want justice," as her coffin was carried by women. Meanwhile, the killing was condemned by Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. We'll have his comments shortly.
I've issued the strongest communique, condemning it, and there will be a full investigation. We're not going to allow mob justice, lynching in any form, shape is unacceptable.
You have more details on this story at voanews.com. The UN Security Council is to hold an emergency meeting on Yemen Sunday. It comes as the United States has withdrawn its personnel from Yemen a day after suicide bombers killed at least 137 people at two mosques in the capital of Sana'a. The number of asylum applicants to the European Union member states increased by 44% in 2014, reaching 626,000 in total. Syrian refugees topped the charts, with Afghani immigrants the second largest group. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote is on assignment.
They've postponed this election before, and they are still wanting to postpone the elections again. They have mounted pressure on Atahi Rujiga, the INEC chairman, to resign. They have mounted pressure on him to go on terminal leave.
Nigerians prepare for next week's elections as the opposition claims the ruling party plans to rig the vote.
Qui se situe non loin de la frontière.
He says Garouabou lies, like other localities that share a boundary with the CAR, now needs particular military attention.
Rebels from the Central African Republic allegedly kidnapped 16 people from Cameroon.
It's restricted to East, Central and Southern Africa, and in those countries it's the most important constraint to livestock productivity. It affects particularly the better breeds of cattle.
And we look at a new discovery that could lead to an effective and much cheaper way to prevent East Coast fever. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. As Nigerians go to polls next week, the ruling party, PDP, says all is ready for the elections. VOA's Peter Clote is in Nigeria and sought out Aminu Salihu Yakodima, the Director General of President Goodluck Jonathan's House-to-House Support Initiative.
Well, very well, fantastic, because we are moving ahead. We are moving to hinterlands because this is a spectacular campaign that has started the Neighbor Wars. It's an initiative that we created so that we can reach the grassroots. So when you see the vibrancy of the campaign, you get carried away because it's a campaign of house to house. This type of campaign became a new campaign strategy because hitherto you see campaigns going by rallies, series of campaigns of razzmatazz and appeals of people moving in large number. Drumming and shouting, etc.
Now, let me ask you this. There were concerns that President Jonathan is having a very difficult time with the northern vote because his opponents come from the north. They said he has an overwhelming support there, so he's not making inroads to get the northern vote in the March 28th election, which is exactly next week. What do you say to that?
Well, the equation is changing, and is changing systematically over a period of time. The gray area that President Jonathan is having is perhaps the northwest and some parts of the northeast. But North Central is intact. And now, because of the understandings of the people, especially what is hindering the campaigns is lack of information, especially on his achievements. But people have now moved to the media because media is the tool that you get to the people, you also inform people through various enlightenment programs.
No, but there have been issues where his opponents are saying the pendulum, or for that matter, the momentum, is on his opponent's side. And that this house-to-house campaign started because his opponent was, you know, giving him a run for his money, and that he could possibly lose the election, and that is why this thing started. What is your take on these assertions?
Well, when you look at the organization, the campaign organization, they have an edge certainly before. This makes us to go back to the drawing board, and all hands are now on deck. With the organizations, things are changing, and are changing drastically. The equation is changing. The formula in terms of strategy is also changing. People are now serious, especially those on the parts of Jonathan, are moving ahead. Perhaps, of course, because Buhari comes from the north. Support is having massive support, he's having a lot of sympathy. But even at that, there are people who are tilting towards Jonathan.
That was Aminu Salihu Yakudima, the Director General of the President Goodluck Jonathan's House-to-House Support Initiative. Meanwhile, the leader of the Northern Anti-Corruption Front, NAF, Comrade Yusuf Yusuf, told my colleague Peter Cloche that the ruling party is putting pressure on Professor Atihiru Jega to go on terminal vacation. This, he said, will enable the People's Democratic Party, PDP, to rig the vote.
The press conference, of course, was to send a message to the international community, to send message to the federal government as well, so that they will not tamper with the forthcoming elections. They've postponed these elections before, and they are still wanting to postpone the elections again. They have mounted pressure on Atahiru Jega, the INEC chairman, to resign. They have mounted pressure on him to go on terminal leave. They have mounted pressure not to use the card reader, the PVC, and so many other agitations which do not hold water.
Now, you said they have done this, they have done that, forcing him to go on retirement or vacation as accrued. Do you have proof of these allegations you're making?
Of course, yes.
What is your proof?
Last week, the OPC, a terrorist group, came up openly with arms and ammunition. They are pushing and agitating that Jega must go, while military were giving them cover and they were destroying opposition's property, causing panic and chaos while the government supports them.
Now,
apart from that, some members of MEND had come out to support the resignation of Jega without the government cautioning them.
I understand that, but Professor Jega came out and said that there is no political pressure on him to go on vacation. So people have a legitimate right to call for his resignation, but it's the federal government that has the final say. The federal government has yet to do that. So what makes of this accusation? Because these you are just groups.
You see, in Nigeria, most especially this political era, rumors are 50% true. We've had series of rumors that come out to be true. The issue of mounting pressure on Jega has stepped up from being a rumor to almost a finalized affair. And as I'm telling you now, I have a classified information that I will not dash out now. But as soon as the time comes, we'll reveal those informations that plans have been concluded to set Jega off his seat. And they've given some conditions for this to happen.
So let me ask you, what is the message of the Northern Anti-Corruption Front after holding this press conference? What message do you want to pass on to Nigerians about this election?
What we're trying to pass across to Nigerians is that Jega has put in everything to prepare these elections. He knows the nooks and crannies of everything around the INEC. And we have only a few days to elections. So he should be allowed to conduct these elections.
That was the leader of the Northern Anti-Corruption Front, NAF, Comrade Yusuf, speaking with my colleague Peter Clote in Abuja. Cameroon says suspected rebels from the Central African Republic have kidnapped 16 people from its territory, including influential local politicians, clergy and businessmen. Although the government says no group has claimed responsibility, it's widely speculated that supporters of rebel leader Abdoulaye Meskane are pressing for his release and that of his fighters who have been arrested and detained in Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
Governor Samuel Dieudonné Ivahadibua of Cameroon's eastern region that shares a boundary with the troubled Central African Republic says the 16 people, including four women, were attacked by at least 30 heavily armed men in Babio on March 19. The kidnapped victims were returning from the burial of a local official of Cameroon's ruling political party, the Cameroon People's Democratic Movement. He says the bus transporting the clergy, politicians and businessmen was seized by the assailants at midnight and taken to the Central African Republic.
Nous prenons maintenant les dispositions pour que nous puissions parer
à ce genre d'événement. Donc, sur le terrain,
he says after the incident, they increased the military and took all necessary security measures to protect the population and handle any other cases of rebel attack on Cameroonian territory. Ivaha Dibua said for close to a year, Eastern Cameroon has not witnessed attacks from CAR rebels, and they believe peace was returning to the troubled nation, but the attack is a sign that the population needs to be vigilant.
Garoua-Boulaye, comme d'autres villes de la région de l'Est qui se situent non loin de la frontière,
he says Garoua-Boulaye, like other localities that share a boundary with the CAR, now needs particular military attention, and he is calling on the population to be vigilant and report all suspects and strangers. Although the governor said no one had claimed responsibility for the attack, it is believed that the kidnappers will seek the release of one of their leaders, Abdoulaye Miskine, and 20 others who were arrested in the Cameroonian town of Betoua and detained in Cameroon. Abdoulaye Miskine, who leads a group called the Democratic Front of the Central African People, fought the Central African Republic government and led to the overthrow of its president, François Bozizé. After falling out with the Seleka and the anti-Balaka rival armed groups, he fled to Cameroon and was arrested 2 years ago. Last year, to press for Abdoulaye Miskine's release, his followers kidnapped 15 Cameroonians and a Polish missionary, Maciek Dziedzic, who worked in the CAR but fled violence and sought refuge in Cameroon. In one of the attacks, the armed men were disguised as CAR refugees. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
Today is World Water Day. This year's theme is water and sustainable development. But now German researchers say groundwater in South Sudan's Unity State is contaminated with waste from oil production. Unity State is one of two states in South Sudan that produce oil. Wake Simon Wudu spoke recently with researchers from the NGO Sign of Hope and African Water Limited, who conducted the study over 6 years.
The study found that 500,000 people living in 4 counties in the north of Unity State have been exposed for years to contaminated water. Sign of Hope Vice Chairman Klaus Stiglitz says the researchers believe they have identified the culprit behind the water pollution.
We found out that there in fact is a direct link between the oil exploration and production activities in the northern parts of Unity State and the contamination of drinking water in this area.
Sign of Hope gathered data for the study between 2008 and 2013. It collaborated on the project with another German company, African Water Limited, which specializes in exploring for groundwater sources and monitoring drinking water resources. Stiglitz says the researchers took samples from mud pits created when companies drill for oil and from basins near processing plants which separate water produced as a byproduct of oil production. Stiglitz says one issue that needs to be addressed in Unity State is the lack of effluent treatment systems. Another problem is that there is no system in place in the areas studied to remove oil waste from water in areas where people live. The absence of treatment and removal systems means that the well water that people drink is more likely to be polluted, Stiglitz says. Hela Ruescam is an official with the African Water Limited. She says the researchers found potentially dangerous heavy metals such as zinc, aluminium, manganese, barium, lead, and iron in some water sources.
All number of heavy metals is always, if you're exceeding some limits, it is always a problem for your health. Yeah, it will cause blood diseases.
Stiglitz says people in the study area complain of stomach pain, diarrhea, and other health problems. Members of a committee from South Sudan's national legislature who visited Unity State to study the impact of oil exploration and production on human health found that some women in the area have given birth to babies without limbs. Stiglitz says Sign of Hope suspects the contaminated water is to blame, and he wants people to be aware of the dangers.
It is our goal to share this information with the affected population of South Sudan in order to create awareness of this issue.
Rescam says it's not just the human health that is in danger from the polluted water. The environment is also at risk, and that puts the livestock on which so many people in South Sudan depend for a living in danger. Some of the photos presented at the launch of the report show the carcass of a cow lying near a well in an area where oil is produced. The researchers say in the report that they suspect high levels of heavy metals in the water killed the animal. Other photos showed animals that had died near ponds containing water produced during crude extraction. South Sudan's economy is heavily dependent on oil. Unity State is the second largest producer of crude in the country after Upper Nile State. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wodo in Juba.
South Africa is adamant that the stockpile of weapons-grade uranium will stay in the country. That's despite pressure from the United States to relinquish it. U.S. President Barack Obama has expressed concern that the nuclear material could be stolen and used for a terrorist attack. Gillian Parker reports from Pelindaba and Johannesburg.
The Pelindaba Nuclear Research Center is nestled in the sparse countryside 30 kilometers from Pretoria, the administrative capital. Large electric fences enclose 48 hectares of the facility, hailed for its contribution to nuclear medicine. Within its gates lie 220 kilograms of weapons-grade uranium, enough to obliterate Washington. A report by the Center of Public Integrity, a non-profit US news organization, details President Obama's attempts to persuade South Africa's President Jacob Zuma to surrender the highly enriched uranium stockpile as part of his global effort to mop up nuclear supplies. Mr. Obama apparently asked Mr. Zuma to exchange the HEU for about 350 kilograms of non-weapons-grade reactor fuel during a state visit in 2013. South Africa has rebuffed those requests. Many South Africans seem angry at Washington's demands that other countries give up nuclear stockpiles while the US maintains its nuclear weapons force. Olisa Mabungo is the group executive at Corporate Services for the South Africa Nuclear Energy Corporation.
South Africa has done more than the US in terms of meeting our commitment. We converted the production of our medical isotopes from HEU to low-enriched uranium.
The United States holds about 4,800 nuclear weapons, down from more than 30,000 in the 1960s. Under the New START treaty with Russia, it is scheduled to reduce its count of nuclear weapons to about 1,550 each. Although there is little concern that South Africa will resume producing weapons of mass destruction, there are fears that the top-grade uranium could fall into terrorist hands. In 2007, a group breached the Pelindaba facility, breaking into the central alarm station. NESCA has since cooperated with the United States to enhance security. On Friday, a US embassy official said in an email to VOA that a US interagency visit to review the newly installed systems was conducted in August 2014, affirming that the facility is secured consistent with international standards. At a conference at Pelindaba this week, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Yukiya Amano, praise South Africa for its peaceful use of nuclear programs.
South Africa is an experienced user of advanced nuclear technology, a leader in many areas, and a valued partner for the IAEA.
South Africa was the first country to dismantle its nuclear weapons program voluntarily, and the first to convert the fuel to be used for medical isotope production. Still, Maite Nkoana Mashabane, the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, is firm that South Africa will not hand over its weapons-grade uranium. Doing so would be an admission that we are unable to be not only a producer, but a safe custodian of the technology for peaceful means, she said this week. Some in South Africa, who support maintaining the stockpile, point out that in the United States, an 82-year-old nun and other activists broke into a highly secure weapons-grade nuclear storage facility at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, in 2012. Gillian Parker for VOA News from Pelindaba and Johannesburg.
Thank you, Gillian. And in Africa, East Coast fever kills one cow every 30 seconds, causing $300 million in annual losses. But a new discovery could lead to an effective and much cheaper way to prevent the disease by pitting one form of parasite against another. VOA's Jody Kapwa reports.
Philip Toy says East Coast fever is a major burden for millions of poor people in Africa, whose existence depends on healthy cattle.
It's restricted to East, Central and Southern Africa, and in those countries, it's the most important constraint to livestock productivity. It affects particularly the better breeds of cattle. It's a lethal disease. It can kill up to 90-95% of a susceptible herd, and death usually occurs in about 2 to 3 weeks.
Toy is a principal scientist at ILRI, the Nairobi-based International Livestock Research Institute. He says the parasitic disease is spread by ticks and has devastating consequences if not controlled.
The means of control at the moment, pesticides, just to reduce the tick burden, is expensive and it requires continual application. And of course, there's also environmental effects there.
Currently, cattle can be inoculated against East Coast fever. It's been shown to reduce calf mortality in some areas from about 50% to less than 3%.
There is a vaccine available which involves inoculating essentially the live parasite, but at the same time giving a long-acting antibiotic, which means the animal experiences the infection but not the disease to any great extent. But they do develop a very strong immunity to the disease. So it's a very effective vaccine. It's very safe when administered correctly, but it's complex to produce and it is expensive.
Toy explains just how complex the vaccine's manufacturing process is.
Experimental cattle are actually infected with the parasite. The ticks are applied to the cattle, and then the ticks are recovered, and they're ground up, and then they're stored in liquid nitrogen. So it takes about 100 cattle, 600,000 ticks, and also rabbits, which are used to mature the parasite before it's ground up. So those costs are quite expensive. And it can take up to 12 to 18 months to produce a batch, because once it's made, it then has to be tested to ascertain the potency of the vaccine.
A batch can range from 500,000 to 1 million doses. Toy says the potential new prevention method is based on a study of co-infections done in Western Kenya.
Up until relatively recently, most research was done looking at microorganisms in isolation. So one would look at the effects of a particular bacterium or a particular virus or a particular parasite. But it's more latterly been recognized that that's actually not what happens in reality, that people and animals get several different microorganisms at the same time. What is the effect of having 2, 3, or 4 different microorganisms? What is the effect of one on the other? Does it make the consequences of that infection more deleterious or is it beneficial?
They discovered that the coexistence of parasites in calves appears to be a good thing in the East Coast fever zone.
With regard to the most important pathogen out in that area, which was Tularemia parva, which causes East Coast fever, that if calves were infected at the same time as they got Tularemia parva with a related organism called Tularemia mutans or Tularemia vilifera, the so-called low pathogenic Tularemia, then the odds of their dying of East Coast fever were significantly reduced. And that's the basis of the paper which is being published.
The findings appear in the journal Science Advances. Toy was asked if he knows why the co-infection greatly reduces the chances of cattle dying of East Coast fever.
No, that's a key question. We don't know if it's helping to remove that infection or is it simply decreasing the effects of the disease that's caused by the infection. But if we could discover that, then it may open up lots of possibilities as to how to control these diseases.
The next step could involve intentionally infecting calves with the less harmful parasites to determine if they can then resist East Coast fever. If so, it could lead to a cheaper, easier-to-make vaccine. Some speculate the findings could be applied to other parasitic diseases, including malaria. Two parasites cause malaria, but one, Plasmodium falciparum, is much more deadly than the other, Plasmodium vivax. A 1996 study suggests that people in the South Pacific who have a genetic mutation making them susceptible to the less deadly parasite may be protected against Plasmodium falciparum. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And see to come in the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from our African collection. That will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. But right now it's time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun on the dot at DMA. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, March 22nd. Nigeria's Dolphins Football Club is still reeling from its disqualification from the 2015 Africa Confederation Cup. The football club, which is based in Nigeria's oil city of Port Harcourt, was kicked out of the competition on Thursday after it arrived late for its first-round first-leg match against host Club Africain of Tunisia on March 14th. African soccer's governing body, CAF, awarded the match to Club Africain, which has now qualified for the second round of the club football competition. Well, the Rivers government, owners of Dolphins Football Club, has formally reacted to the CAF decision. Commissioner for Sports, Freddy Gwe, says the committee inaugurated on Friday will probe the disqualification.
We, as a ministry, we have decided that we will not let it lie low, neither are we going to just allow the matter pass without some form of action. But before we take any action, it will be necessary for us to know exactly what transpired, exactly why they were not able to keep or to honor their international assignment. And so as a responsible ministry, we decided to set up a committee that will investigate circumstances surrounding their inability or failure to honor the match that led to their being walked over.
That was the Rivers State Commissioner for Sports, Freddy Gwe, speaking on the Dolphins' disqualification from the 2015 CAF Confederation Cup. Many thanks to reporter Tony Tamuno in Port Harcourt for the audio. Staying with African football, Zimbabwe has assured that it will fulfill its African football fixtures despite a cash crunch that has triggered its disqualification from the 2018 FIFA World Cup. The Zimbabwe Football Association said the country will honor its engagements in the All-Africa Games and the CAF Under-23 Championships. Last week, Zimbabwe was dropped as an entrant to the 2018 World Cup African Zone draw in Russia after failing to pay the money owed to a former coach. Coach Valinho from Brazil led the Zimbabwean national team for most of 2008, and Zimbabwe admits it's been owed $67,000 in salaries and allowances. After missing various deadlines set by FIFA to pay the coach, Zimbabwe was expelled from the World Cup. But the Southern African country said it had not abandoned hope of paying the coach and getting back into the World Cup draw. In more African football news, the Egyptian Premier League will resume on March 30th behind closed doors. The league, as well as other football competitions, had been frozen since February 8th, when 20 Zamalek supporters were killed after the police used tear gas to disperse a crowd of fans who were attempting to enter the stadium ahead of a league match with MP. Most of the Premier League games have been played behind closed doors since February 2012, when over 70 Al Ahly fans were killed after being attacked by Al Masry fans in Port Said Stadium during a league match. Meanwhile, former Sierra Leone head coach John McKinstry has been named the new coach of Rwanda's national football team, known as the Amavubi Stars. Irishman McKinstry replaces Stephen Constantine, who resigned in January. Despite the appointment of a new coach, interim coach Lee Johnson will preside over the March 29 friendly against Zambia in Lusaka. Johnson has already named a 26-man squad for the match. Talking about the appointment of a new coach, Senegal Football Association President Augustin Senghor has unveiled Aliou Cissé as the new coach of the country's national football team. The former international takes over from Alain Jures, who did not renew his contract. Cisse has already recalled Demba Ba for the team's friendly against Ghana next Saturday, and Uganda may have replaced Bolivia in the football friendly. According to the football website goal.com, Nigerian football officials said the Super Eagles will now play against the Cranes of Uganda in the southern city of Uyo on Wednesday. The game will be played earlier than scheduled to allow fans to travel ahead of Saturday's presidential elections in Nigeria. Bolivia pulled out of a previously scheduled match against Nigeria, citing civil unrest in the West African nation, perhaps an apparent reference to the Boko Haram insurgency. World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has released its 2014 financial report, and it shows that the organization made a profit of $2.6 billion from the 2014 FIFA World Cup. The tournament cost Brazil an estimated $15 billion, a significant portion of which was public money. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Umpuga in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. Segun on the dot, Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports right here on Nightline Africa. Yes, it's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to enjoy some music from the continent. So just sit down, relax, and enjoy.
I can show you the thing we go bossy. Bugatti. Hey, I'm born in a Bugatti. Hey, I go buy you Ferrari. You don't get any choice but to marry. Hey, I go give you the khaki. Hey, you be calling me daddy. I'm on to café. Je m'appelle on the go. Je vais danser avec toi. Faut danser avec moi. Hey, I know you like go. Body. Oh, yeah, move body. Make you ring alarm. Oh, yeah, shake body. Them girls just they feel me now. Cause I get some money, then they feel me now. Back then they do me anyhow. I don't get some money, they wanna get down. They won't hold me for ransom. Cause I'm young and I'm rich and I'm handsome. They won't know where I come from. I they run to from Lagos to London. All the blessings and love I they see, just they make me they shout hallelujah. Eh? I say all the blessings and love I they see, just they make me they shout hallelujah. Eh? They hold me for ransom, cause I'm young and I'm rich and I'm handsome. They won't hold me for ransom, cause I'm young and I'm rich and I'm handsome. Oh yeah, shake body. Oh yeah, move body. Make you ring alarm. Oh yeah, shake body. Kalema, sagacité, équilibré, farotema, décalé, décalé, cricata, 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 pam pam. Somunto, somunto, calopere, calopere, calopere. All the blessings and love I decide, just they make me they shout hallelujah. Eh? I say all the blessings and love I decide, just they make me they shout hallelujah. Eh? They hold me for ransom, cause I'm young and I'm rich and I'm handsome. They won't hold me for ransom, cause I'm young and I'm rich and I'm handsome. Oh yeah, shake body.
Just to let you go. I want to keep you and I'll go let you go. Come on.
And that was our Sunday music spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music coming up from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Advisor General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The decision of China to promote the establishment of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB, has gained much press coverage in recent days, primarily because the close allies of the United States in Europe, France, Germany, Italy, and United Kingdom are defying the United States by declaring their intentions to become founding members of the Chinese-led bank. Other European states and South Korea and Australia are planning to join. While the media coverage has examined the concern that the Infrastructure Investment Development Bank might lack transparency with weak banking rules and procedures, the fundamental motivation of China to establish the bank has not been sufficiently analyzed. Of course, mention has been made that the United States is worried that the Chinese-led bank might weaken the standing of the Washington-based Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the IMF, banks that were established in 1944. At a time when the full development of decolonization in Asia and Africa was just a dream. A serious missing link in the examination of the Chinese Asian Development Bank was the neglect to mention the establishment of the BRICS Bank in the summit of the BRIC countries in Durban, South Africa in 2013. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa were reflecting the deep frustration of countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America regarding the reluctance or refusal to make sensible major reforms in the management of the World Bank and the IMF. For example, allotment of weighted voting in the institutions at a time when the membership was predominantly European could have made sense, but insensitive and a symbol arrogance of power when these institutions have become global organizations? Why is it, after so many decades, should the IMF be led by a European country and the World Bank by the United States? China, the second largest economy in the world, with a $4 trillion foreign reserve, has not been able to obtain commensurate voting power in these institutions. Accordingly, the drive to establish the BRICS Bank and the China-led Asian Bank is aimed at establishing global rules with greater balance and more in line with modern realities. Perhaps the absence of any major U.S. allies in the membership of the BRIC Bank may have drawn less attention than the Chinese-led bank where there will be European members. The United Kingdom, in particular, has asserted that it would endeavor to make reforms in the Chinese-led bank to ensure that its procedures are not too dissimilar from those of the IMF and the World Bank. But this attempt might cause problems. Countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America have long complained of the conditionalities of the World Bank and the IMF, such as the so-called Washington Consensus, environmental and human rights concerns. China is already investing heavily in Africa, in the infrastructure of Africa's railroads. Western countries have criticized China for not applying the IMF and the World Bank conditionalities in its trade with Africa in particular. But the Chinese approach has been warmly embraced by countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. A lesson to be kept in mind is the risk that failure to make sensible reforms in time might provoke reaction. For example, in the United Nations Security Council, the veto power has not changed since 1945, and the reform promised by the organization has not happened. Failure to proceed might produce reactions which may surprise the five permanent members. Of course, United Kingdom, Germany, Italy, and France are keen to join the Chinese-led bank because of China's huge export and investment market. I thank you.
Thank you. That was a one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world is changing, and so is diplomacy and development. Global challenges such as climate change, poverty, terrorism, and disease are often too expansive and complex to be met by any one government or group. Addressing such problems requires innovation, ingenuity, and collaboration across diverse sectors. In 2009, the Secretary's Office of Global Partnerships was established at the U.S. State Department to promote the development of public-private partnerships to leverage the best of public and private sector resources to create practical solutions for such challenges. The office, which has leveraged over $829 million in public and private resources since 2009, engages companies, startups, NGOs, foundations, faith-based organizations, universities, research centers, and civil society groups as full partners in the process of problem-solving. In Africa, the three-year-old Liberalizing Innovation Opportunity Nations Partnership, or Lions at Africa, mobilizes the knowledge, expertise, and resources of leading public and private institutions to encourage and enhance technology and innovation by investing in capacity building for startups, providing access to capital, promoting connectivity with global markets, and raising the credibility of the startup culture. Some 2,000 entrepreneurs have participated in Lions at Africa-supported capacity-building activities. Over 80 startups were launched at Demo Africa, a signature annual event, and raised more than $10 million in capital financing to date. In 2013, five Lions innovators won opportunities to present their ideas at the main demo event in the United States High-Tech Center, Silicon Valley. Over 30 Lions won opportunities to compete in South Africa at a global pitch event for leading international investors. And 80 children are participating in pilot Africoder Dojo programs in Nigeria and Tanzania that provide free computer coding sessions and mentoring to young people. Many more coding clubs are planned across the continent. As with our nation's public-private partnership efforts in other parts of the world, Lions at Africa leverages the financial and in-kind resources of both the public and private sectors. It brings together leading IT companies, international development organizations, technology associations, and startup accelerators and incubators across the African continent to develop flagship programs and initiatives that deliver widespread results.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.